of yet another week, and if I'm not mistaken, it's the last full week in June. It is. In fact, a week from, what is it, a week from Sunday? 4th of July. Zoom. Peter Davenport is with us tonight, this first hour. We have a special report, a very unusual report from an eyewitness. We're very honored to have him on. Peter, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jeff, and boy, is that eerie and ominous-sounding bumper music you use to start off this program. It's appropriate for the times we live in, I think.
I agree. the times we live in. For those of us who can remember, you know, the 50s and 60s, and we lived in the best of times, and now we're seeing the worst of times. I don't know how much worse they can get, but you look at what's happening in the Gulf, the economy, politics, the threat of war in the Middle East, the ongoing war in Afghanistan, the Iraq war. Where do you begin and where do you end the list? It just goes on and on. So these are times that try men's and women's souls, and it's not easy. Not easy.
Yeah, it sure is. We live in bizarre times, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. It concerns me profoundly, as it does, I'm sure, every one of your listeners and
they agree.
Followers.
Yeah, that's why they're here. Yeah.
Yep.
They'd rather know than not know. And for those who say, come on, and that's all right. I want to tell you something, folks. The chasm between those who get it or are at least trying to get it and those who don't get it and don't want to get it is so big, it's not, you can't connect. There's a complete break in separation. That's my view. I just don't think that there's any common ground between these two groups of people. Unfortunately, the majority is the group that doesn't get it and really doesn't want to get it. I don't know how much of a majority, but it's a majority. We try our best to put it out there for those who care and try and help them fine-tune their receivers if they're already looking for this kind of information. That's all we can do. Peter, of course, is the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, in case you don't know it. And he has a brilliant website, ufocenter.com, whereupon you can find and immerse yourself in some of the most amazing reading of honest human encounters and human events that you'll ever imagine. So, again, I would challenge you educators out there in high school, even middle school, to put in a unit on unidentified flying objects. Talk to Peter. You're certainly welcome to use his material. He probably would consult with you and maybe even make a phone call to your class. Who knows? But that's up to you folks, and I hope that some of you go there because it's an enormously important subject. When you figure that the second most popular, is it the second or first? Second.
Might be the first by
no,
now. Hard to
well,
know.
It's the porn is pretty dominant, but it's the second most popular website on the internet, that being a UFO ET oriented website. So it's huge. This is worldwide. So, but yet we don't see it in the classroom. No, no. And it doesn't exist according to the people in our nation's capital. So Peter, go ahead and tell us what we have on tap tonight, please.
Well, we have a very, very interesting witness with an interesting story to tell that comes out of Afghanistan. And it's a relatively recent story. Only 2 weeks ago, an object was seen over a combat area in Afghanistan. And by the way, Jeff, thank you very much for making time available on such a short notice. This report just came in a couple days ago, and I'm delighted to be able to report this is one of the rare occasions when not only am I on the Jeff Rentz radio program, but in addition to that, we have an announcement on the National UFO Reporting Center detailing that fact, and we also have this report posted. Very, very nice report from a gentleman who's standing by in the Eastern time zone he's home on leave from the war in Afghanistan, and he's been kind enough to make time available while he's home with his family to share his sighting experience with all of the Jeff Rentz listeners. On the 11th of June, I believe it was, I'm going on memory now, this gentleman was on duty in Afghanistan. He was on guard duty, I believe I'm correct in saying, he may correct me when he comes on the air here in a moment or two. And looking to the north, he saw a very, very bizarre object, triangular-shaped object, with very characteristic lights on it. The fact that it had lights, he points out in his report, is very unusual, because aircraft in a combat area do not display lights for an obvious reason.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating report. Our listeners will be able to go to our website and read the report while they're listening to our guest tonight. And I think he's going to go by the name Frank to make it simple.
Fine with me.
And I trust we have him on the line.
Yep.
Why don't we just go to Frank and allow him to introduce himself to our audience and tell his story. It's a fascinating story.
Hi, Frank. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, Frank, and thanks for coming on tonight.
Not a problem. Not a problem at all.
Frank, also, I want to pass along Peter and my and all of our listeners' respects and good wishes and how much we honor your commitment in serving your country. It's not easy over there. It's a tough situation. And if I might ask just a quick question, I don't want to get you in trouble. What was your reaction to the departure of McChrystal and his replacement with Petraeus? Anything?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that because I might get fired.
All right. No comment. Well done. Okay. So what you're saying is you probably won't have a McChrystal in 2012 bumper sticker on your car for a number of reasons. All right. Very good. Frank, tell us what's going on over there. What part of Afghanistan were you in approximately?
Okay, we're based in the Nandahar province, which is one of the hotbeds in the area.
Kandahar, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Nandahar.
Nandahar, that's
right. It's a hotbed.
Okay.
Is that a different province from Kandahar, I gather?
Yes, it's a little further south, closer to the border of Pakistan, where these guys are sneaking in through.
Mm-hmm. Like a freeway back and forth, I understand.
Yes, it is. It's the main highway for all these Taliban guys to come in and out of the mountains and shell us. We've been getting shelled like crazy for the last couple of weeks.
Well,
we lost five guys in our base alone in one night.
Oh boy!
So it's hairy out there.
Yeah,
but we're doing our jobs.
You are doing your jobs, and the bravery of our American men and women over there is just extraordinary when you consider the totality of what we're doing there. It's been going on almost 9 years. It's bizarre. Okay, so you're on guard duty, my friend. It's nighttime, I guess. Tell us more.
Okay, yeah. It was, I believe, June 11th, and my shift was from 1800 to 600 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sitting there because it's so dark over there. I mean, oh, man, it's so dark. We have no lights on anywhere in the place, so it's completely mad dark. It was a cloudy night. The cloud ceilings were about, I'd say, 4,000 feet.
Are you up in a guard tower or are you down low?
I'm in a guard tower.
Okay.
It's about 20 feet up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at my phone, contemplating on calling my wife, and I'm counting the time zone, which is a 9.5-hour difference time zone, and I noticed that I still had about an hour and a half left to call my wife, because I call her every night.
That's so nice that you're able to do that. That's just extraordinary. Oh.
Technology, you got to love it.
Yeah.
So I look at the phone and I was like, okay, I still have an hour and a half. You know, it's 11:30 at night over there, so I'll wait. And at that moment, I happen to look out the window, and I'm facing north. So at my 2:00, I notice a string of lights, looked like three of them, but they were pretty big. It was over the mountains. The mountains are about a mile and a half away from us.
Mm-hmm.
The highest peak we have there is about 1,800 feet. So I could still see some space between the tip of the mountain and the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I saw a string of lights, and then I'm wondering, you know, what the hell is that? Because there shouldn't be anything with lights on out there.
And that's your job, to identify unusual things, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hold on, so Frank. Would you please? We have to take a short break. We'll come right back in just a minute. On guard duty, Peter, and you see something bizarre. We'll ask Frank what his first response was. It's quite a story. when we continue. You can see the report again at UFOCenter.com. Peter and I will be right back with Frank in just a couple minutes. Okay, let's jump right back into our conversation with Frank. All right, Frank, you're up there, and you're trained to, when you see something that doesn't, not supposed to be there, what is your first obligation to do? What do you do?
Well, when it comes to unidentified flying objects, there's not really much you can do, and you really don't want to report it, which I didn't report it through the radio. I've told the sergeant of the guard the next following day what I saw.
Uh-huh.
And to him, it was a joke. You know.
So he just dismissed it.
Yeah, several people dismissed it. Some people believed me, but most of them dismissed it. They tried to tell me either we're flying helicopters. No, helicopters don't move at a formation that thing was moving in.
Mm-hmm.
And I also told them that, you know, at night, nothing flies. They know that. Nothing flies with the lights on. I mean, guys could land a C-130 in the dark on a dime.
Wow.
You know, so...
Wow. And
so
you have night vision. You have night vision goggles too, of course.
Yes. So when I saw the object, I was sitting inside the tower, and I see the, like I was saying, I saw the lights heading. It was in my north at my 2 o'clock, heading from east to west. So I grabbed the night vision, and I run outside the tower. And by the time I got out there, the object was gone. So I stood staring in the same area, more or less, of where I last saw it, and lo and behold, I see an object coming out of a left bank turn. And as it leveled out, I can see it's five lights in a delta-shaped formation, a big V formation.
Huh.
And I'm trying to figure out the size of this thing because it's past the mountains, which is about a mile and a half away from me.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the clouds. I couldn't see the object itself. I just saw the lights. But distance is hard to tell at night, but I know it's far away, and it's at least 3,000-4,000 feet up in the air, and this thing is freaking huge.
Mm-hmm.
So I called the next tower next to me, Tower 8, and I tell him, hey, look towards the northern mountains above in the skies and tell me if you see anything. And I guess the other guy in the other tower was asleep because all he said was, all I see is a building in front of me. I'm telling him, look up.
Uh-huh.
But by the time he looked up, this object has already moved from my 12 o'clock right over us.
Uh-huh.
And I'm amazed on the freaking size of this thing. This thing was huge.
Directly overhead now.
It's right over the base.
Oh, my.
You know, and it's spinning around because it was pointing towards us, as towards the base as it's coming towards me. And as it's coming, it's slowly spinning, gliding sideways. And next thing you know, it's facing north again.
So this thing actually rotated on its axis, so to speak, and was just floating along sideways.
Mm-hmm.
How bizarre.
Yeah, fishtailing. It was just like fishtailing, and it was weird. So then finally it hovered over us, and it finished its turn and stood above me for about 2 seconds. And I'm trying to get an estimated size on this thing, and like I said, it's in the clouds. I cannot see the entire object, but I see the lights in a perfect triangular formation.
One in the front, two on the sides, two in the back kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at the base, and I'm looking up in the sky, and I notice that the tip of this thing is outside of the base. Then I run to the sides of the tower to try to get another estimated size of the wings, where the last of the lights were at, and they also were sticking outside of the base. And our base is pretty big. I mean, it's not huge, but at least it's like two city blocks put together. So basically, right. If it parked right over us, the points will be off sticking outside the base.
Got it. And how many towers are there on the base?
9 towers.
And did you call anybody else beside the guy next to you?
They can all hear the same radio.
And did you get any chatter back?
No, everybody's looking different directions. Nobody's bothered to looking up, and I'm over here screaming, look up.
But, and? Did anybody
and
look up?
To look up. Apparently not. Nobody else saw it. I was the only one. Which kind of, you know, burns me up a little bit, but.
What was the reaction of the sergeant of the guard, Frank? That's the person who's in charge of guards on duty.
Right.
Do you think that sergeant also saw the object and just didn't admit it over the radio or over your landline?
No, he was either inside the TOC building or the BDOC building. I mean, the sergeant of the guard really just checks on us every hour, walks around, but instead of walking around, he'll call us and do radio tower checks instead of just going physically to check.
You said something just a few moments ago about how big it was. What I'd like you to do is hold up your thumbnail at arm's length with one eye closed and tell me how big was the object relative to your thumbnail or relative to the size of your fist held at clenched fist at arm's length with one eye closed. How big did it appear to be?
At clenched fist, over the mountains, it was the size of my fist. And by the time it was over me, my fist ain't big enough.
You'd have to hold up a 6-foot square piece of cardboard or something to cover it up?
6-foot piece.
Well, whatever. In other words, something very big.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, something, yeah.
All right, I can't believe
phenomenal.
That. No, that would just burn me up, too, if none of the other guys in the other towers, they're looking around, they're not looking up, and you tell them to look up, and nobody's looking up. Do you think they did see it and just didn't want to say anything?
That's a possibility, because right now I'm the joke of the fob, you know. Oh, hey, this is the guy that sees UFOs at night, you know. And it's like, look, I've never seen Bigfoot. I've never seen Loch Ness Monster. I've never seen anything. I've never seen pink elephants. But I know what I saw that night, and what I saw was a huge unidentified flying object for the simple reason it was huge. I couldn't identify it. All I could see was five lights in the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not even flying, gliding.
No noise.
No sound, nothing. And the funny part about it was that night we had winds traveling at about 25, 30 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And when the wind blows over there, it blows. It just keeps blowing. It doesn't slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that thing went right over us, it was a dead stop. I mean, you couldn't hear anything at all. No birds, no crickets, no wind.
So it was. You think it was clearly surveilling your base?
Yeah, because there's two bases right there. We have our base in one side, and on the other side of the mountain is the main airport strip called JBAD.
Got it. All right.
Which is basically just Jalalabad.
Got it. Stand by, Frank, please. We'll be back with more in just a couple minutes. Fascinating, Peter. Just really amazing.
Yep,
it sure is.
Okay, welcome back. Peter and I and Frank, very honored to have a man serving this country over here on leave from Afghanistan come forward with such a story. All right, we're with you. You're outside the guard tower looking up, and this thing is obviously in the clouds over your base. Would this be a security violation?
in a most major way.
I would say. But again, the only person you reported to was your immediate superior the next day. Do you think that he went up to the base commander or the upper echelons and mentioned it to them, and they just...
Yes, he did. Yes, he did, because I was getting some peculiar comments on my little experience. The lieutenant came by and told me he wanted to check with me. Is it true that you saw a UFO? And I told him, yes, sir. I described it to him. He says he believes me, but I've got that little piece of doubt in his mind of saying, nah, you know, but he says, well, next time if I see one, take a picture. Which, believe me, after that night, I've been up there with my camera every night, and it never showed up again. I mean, I'm not saying it might not ever show up again. I mean, I might see it again, might not ever see it again. I mean, I'm 50 years old right now, and like I said, I've never seen Bigfoot, never seen a chupacabra, never seen pink elephants, you know, never seen this, what I saw.
Well, you're
night,
the perfect,
phenomenal.
The perfect eyewitness.
Yeah. So,
in a way. Did anyone tell you didn't see anything? Don't talk about it.
No. Nobody said anything like that yet.
Good.
I mean, because it's all basically National Guardsmen. You know, we're all from the same hometown. And, you know, we know each other in the reserves and outside. Some of us are, you know, hang out privately with friends. You know, we have our own friends. And
sure.
It's like a little family thing, you know. So just, right. I expected to get ripped about it, which I do.
That's okay. I'm sure it's all done with no malice intended. They're just teasing
true.
You. Yeah. Okay, Peter?
But
I would like to go back to the pattern of lights, Frank. You've represented that the object was generally triangular in shape. It was very large, probably larger than your base, based on what
definitely
you
said. Larger than the base.
And I'm curious to know, there are many different types of triangles, of course. Was it a sharp, narrow triangle, or was it an equilateral triangle? Could you describe
that? It was in the clouds. It was in the clouds. I couldn't see it. All I know was in a five triangular shape, or, you know, like an arrowhead.
And were all five lights on just two legs of the triangle, or were they equally distributed around the triangle? Could you describe how the lights were situated on what you interpreted to be a triangular craft?
Well, you had the one in the front, and then behind that you had two to the sides, and then further spread apart, two more again to the sides.
On which side? Were all the lights on two sides or on three sides?
On two sides, yes.
Pardon?
Two sides.
Two sides.
There was none in the back. So I really couldn't tell, the shape of it. All I know is that one in front center, two behind it, and then two more behind those further spread apart.
Were those back two, do you think, at the corner tips of the triangle, perhaps?
Probably.
You can't tell you're in the clouds up there, whatever it is, and so you're looking up.
Yeah, that was my only major drawback, is I couldn't see it directly. All I could see were the lights.
Mm-hmm. And they moved in absolute unison. It was
yes.
Clearly a one-piece of hardware.
Yes, you can tell it was one piece. You can definitely tell it was one piece, because, like I said, when the sergeant suggested it might be helicopters, hold it there, because no helicopters flying at night with the lights on.
Got it.
Every aircraft we have is total blackout. This thing was in a perfect formation. I mean, they could try and fly five helicopters and try to glide. It would never stay in the formation.
I understand. Well, it's windy too, as you said.
Exactly, and that's like I said, it was windy. The winds were about 25, 35 miles an hour. It was strong. It was pushing me, but as soon as that thing came over us, everything went dead silent. I mean, I didn't hear anything at all.
Oh, you mean wind? The wind didn't. It stopped, or it didn't make any more noise?
Yes, it just did stop.
It stopped?
Dead stopped.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Oh, that's too much.
Stop. Everything was total silence. I mean, every night we hear crickets. There was no crickets around. There was nothing. Everything was... It was like if I was in a surreal world. It's like as soon as it came over us, it's like everything suddenly went surreal. I mean, it's real, but it's not real. You know, and I know what I'm looking at. It was total silence. And as it started to drift sideways towards the west over the Kuchi tribe, because there's a tribe, a tribal village about 1,000 meters away from our base, and it flew over their village just a little further down, I'd say maybe about a mile away, and then all of a sudden it just shot like a blink of an eye right back up to the northern mountains, and it was gone. And as soon as it did that, the wind just poof, almost knocked me off the tower.
What direction was the wind blowing before it calmed down? Can you estimate that?
East to west.
East to west, and yet the object came at you from the north, I think you said.
Well, it was in the north. It was traveling from the east side to the west, and it stopped at my 12 o'clock.
So it went against the wind. I see.
Mm-hmm. Then it started coming towards me, and as soon as it came over me, it spun around. Wind stopped. It drifted towards the left, towards the west again, passing the Kuchi tribe, and bash, it was just gone in an instant.
Approximately how long did the wind stop and that silent moment or two exist?
From the moment it came over us till the moment it passed us.
What?
That was the only time the wind stopped that the entire night.
What, 60 seconds?
No, it took me about maybe 10 seconds or slightly less for the whole experience. So for the 2 seconds it was over us, it's the only time the wind stopped.
Do you think it may have been just a natural pause in the wind? Doesn't sound
no,
like
No, not in Afghanistan. It doesn't stop like that. It slows down and it stops, but when it's high winds like that, just blowing and blowing and blowing, it'll blow all night.
Peter, we don't get too many, on my desk, too many reports where a wind is actually, if this is what happened, shut down like that with a craft overhead. That's very odd. The silence, we've heard that forever.
Yep.
But the wind being interfered with, stopped, neutralized, whatever you want to call it, that's very strange.
Yeah, it is.
It's very freaky, if you ask me.
I may have a few reports like that, but I agree, Jeff. They're very sparse in number, and that's a very unusual occurrence. Did any of the other guards, any of the people on the other, what did you say, eight towers, comment on that? Did they notice it as well? Do you have any way of knowing, Frank?
No, nobody said anything. I've talked to all the guys the next following day, you know, and like half of them, you must have been drinking that Haji grain juice, and it's like, no. Or, you know, they're just thinking, imagining things. No, I know what I saw. I know what I saw.
We believe you. You're loud and clear on that. And we know voices. And we'll be right back with more as we continue our conversation with Frank. Next. Okay, let's get back to Frank. All right, Frank, anything you want to add to this excellent report? And how did you find the National UFO Reporting Center to make this report?
Like I said, thank goodness for technology. I went into the internet, put down UFO, and the list popped out, my pictures, and there it was.
Very good.
I really, really appreciate your taking the time and trouble. And most of all, Frank, I commend you for having gone against the grain and submitted the report, even though possibly, as Jeff has pointed out, it might have been a threat to your position in the military. But this is a classic example of the importance of people who've seen things that are really interesting to come forward and share it, report it. In this case, doesn't appear to be, you haven't suffered in the least from it, as far as I can determine.
No, I have to go back. I have to finish up 5 more months over there. I got to see what the reaction is when I get back.
Yeah.
But other than that, I don't think I should have any problems at all.
No, you got a great group, obviously, and they probably, some of them are jealous they didn't get to see it.
Well, yeah, actually, a few of them were jealous. They were pretty upset when I told them about it. Like, oh no, and I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're avid UFO watchers on TV, Discovery Channel, HBO, stuff like that. You know, I never expected to see one in my entire life. You know, and it's like I finally saw one. Now the question is, who's going to believe me and who's not? And actually, I don't care if they do or don't.
That's the way to do it. Yeah. Now I've never seen one, so you got me, and I hear a lot of wonderful reports. None more amazing than this one. I mean, that's quite a scene. Would you like to see it again?
Honestly, yes, I would. Because when I first seen it, I was scared, but at the same time, I was so excited that I'm actually looking at a UFO. You know, so I was really scared, but at the same time, excited. So it was a mixed emotion, but I kind of enjoyed that whole moment. You know.
Well, I'm really glad that they didn't send you to the medic or the base, whoever handles depression and psychiatric issues and mood issues.
Oh, yeah, we got lots of those people all over the place.
Do you really?
Yeah. You know, trauma, but, you know, I mean, 1 minute you're with your buddy, next thing you know, he's everywhere around you, you know. And that's really traumatic for all of us.
You know,
so they have every kind of head shrink counselors, everybody there talking to us.
Well, that's good that you have the support there, but it's something you never get over.
Yeah.
I don't care what they say. Frank, we salute you, we honor you, we appreciate you, and keep up the great work and be safe.
All right. Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity of letting me tell my story.
Our pleasure.
Boy, it's been wonderful, Frank. Thanks very much for coming on such short notice and for coming on at all. We are really grateful to you.
Yeah, not a problem. Anything else pops up in the next 5 months, I'll give you guys a call again.
Call us from there. I mean, call us anytime, please.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, we can make calls from there.
Spread the word among your fellow soldiers over there that if they see anything or if they encounter any of their colleagues who believe they've seen something, we would welcome those reports as you've done.
Not a problem.
All right. Be well.
Okay.
All right, gentlemen. Have a good one. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's a really neat story. It's full of all kinds of dimensions. It's a very amazing venue. I mean, here's a man out literally in the pitch black darkness of a country halfway around the world, and something like this happens. And they've got guard towers all around the perimeter, and he's yelling at everybody, and no one's looking up. At least no one's saying they're looking up.
Yeah, that's quite a story. It is reminiscent of a report I remembered, Jeff, that I received back in June of 1991. It was that Desert Storm, I think. Do I have the name right?
Desert Shield and then Desert Storm is the way it worked out.
Yeah, that's right. Shield and Storm. I figured you would remember those names. A fellow who was a cook was bivouacked in either a 6 or an 8-man tent. And he woke up one night and saw a very strange creature standing inside his tent. He said it looked like the Michelin Man, rotund white creature that the Michelin Tire Company uses for their advertisements.
Like
and
Pillsbury
it came
Doorboy,
right up to him.
Uh-huh.
He tried to scream to wake up the other occupants of his tent, and he couldn't get a scream out. All of the other soldiers, all of the other troops in his tent were sound asleep, apparently could not be raised. And this creature just came up to the witness and touched his forehead, at which point he lost all consciousness. He doesn't remember what happened from that point forward. But he reported to us, and he submitted a very nice written report. I actually met with him at McCord Air Force Base, south of Seattle, about 30 or 40 miles, and he described to me and another investigator in great detail what all of it looked like. So it appears that these sightings, these events take place during wartime and in combat areas just as they do everywhere else on the planet Earth. It's very interesting. You have to wonder what they're up to. Are they observing? Are they participating? Just what are they doing?
I remember John Timmerman on this program many years ago describing how he would take his table and his backdrop with pictures of UFOs and just sit in shopping malls. He'd get permission and he'd set up and he'd have a tape recorder. And he was busy all day. Every time he'd do it, he said, people would come up, they want to talk. Yep. One guy was a Korean War veteran and described how they were on a hillside in a village down below. And they were engaged in a firefight back and forth. And he said, this is daylight. A silver disc appeared in the distance, moving toward them, came across the village right up the hillside. And this guy said he had an M1, and he shot at it, and he could hear the bullets bouncing right off of it. It was one of the most amazing stories I'd ever heard.
Yeah. I think I've talked to John about that case. I've had the great pleasure of meeting with John Timmerman on a number of occasions. We've talked on many more occasions over the telephone and over the internet, and he's done a wonderful job of documenting many, many cases that would have slipped through the cracks had he not been actively pursuing them, as you say, at shopping malls and everywhere else. So he's done a great job for Center for UFO Studies out in Chicago. I think he's worked for them for in excess of four decades.
Yeah.
He remembers Dr. J. Allen Hynek very well, worked closely with him for many decades.
Well, he's a real gentleman and a credit to the whole business of investigating this. And he has so many tapes, thousands of them apparently, and I got the feeling from talking to him that they're going to end up in somebody's garage somewhere, and here are these amazing pieces of history, like the one we're talking about. But
I'm confronted with the same problem, Jeff. I've got all these cassette tapes, which I've made over the last 16 years. I've got to digitize them and get them on CD-ROMs.
Oh, yeah.
But it is a very, very time-consuming process. You have to
play each one of those tapes into a computer, digitize it, make a file, and then burn it to a CD-ROM. And I have to do that in addition to working two shifts a day answering the telephone.
Yeah. So. Well, and then if you want to get real proficient, you'll pull in software, and there's all kinds of noise reduction things that can be done to these tapes to make them even sound better. You're going to have to hire somebody to do it. I couldn't do it. I don't know how you even start.
Yeah.
We're restoring the archives here back to 1994, and I've got several people working on it, helping out, and it's quite a job. Some of the tapes are on cassette. Some of the tapes are on, I guess they're just MP3 format. Some of them, of course, are on DAT, DAT tapes, which were only around for about a year. Some of them were on years, 5 years, were on VHS videotapes, just the sound. And the sound, and anyway, to correct the sound, and to fix the sound, and to transfer the sound, as you say, is, wow, it's amazing.
Yep.
But
even CD-ROMs are not all that long-lived. They last only for about 20 or 25 years, even in the best of conditions.
Correct. Yeah.
So,
well, there'll be a new technology along which will very shortly make them last a lot longer than that. Whatever format it is, the whole thing is changing so darn fast. It's just crazy. Anything new from you on the oil situation?
Well, I'm following it carefully, and I just before the program, I saw the first article I've seen on the internet discussing what's going to happen if we have a tropical storm or, God forbid, a hurricane in the Caribbean or in the Gulf of Mexico that not only stirs up this oil but whips it up into a froth and sends it tens or hundreds of miles inland.
Oh, it could send it all the way up into the Midwest.
Yep.
And then it rains a cursor of oil. It's actually the oil in an earlier stage. They drilled down too deep, got into an area they shouldn't be in, and we are paying attention. No one's doing it. All they're doing is drilling these relief wells, which are not going to work. Meanwhile, the Gulf is being destroyed. No air quality, no air monitoring at all is being released to the public. None. That tells you a lot.
And I am equally perturbed by the fact that apparently journalists are being denied access to areas where they should be allowed or should be able to travel at will.
You bet.
And they're being denied access by people who are not officials. They are not members of law enforcement.
Nope.
They are just thugs, as I can tell.
That's it. That's exactly what's going on down there. Civil control has been lost to contractors, as they call them. Thugs, as you call them. They're punks, a lot of them. It's not good. The university went out and tested the water and found methane in the water at over a million times higher than it should be concentrations.
Yes, I saw that report.
That's
scary. I think I saw it on your website,
if I'm not
mistaken.
Correct. All right. We got to run. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks,
as always.
Appreciate the airtime and on short notice particularly.
Indeed. Take care of yourself.
Good night.
Talk soon. All right. We'll be right back with more in a minute. Glad to have you along tonight, hour number two. We have two very special guests this hour and two special guests the next hour as well. Noe Torres is back tonight. He, of course, with Ruben Uriarte, wrote the book, The Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash. It's quite a book. We've had them both on before. They were kind enough to bring a very famous gentleman on who has created quite a stir since he was on. Let's say hello to Noe first and bring him back on. How are you?
Good evening, Jeff. I'm so happy to be back on your show again. I appreciate you inviting me tonight. And I'm so looking forward to discussing the infamous Roswell UFO crash tonight with you.
We will. And how is Colonel Willingham? I just want to toss that out there.
Colonel Willingham is doing well. He has been settling into his summer routine. He goes to various family reunions, and he celebrates a birthday in August. So are kind of gearing down for the summer, and he's enjoying himself there in his hometown near Wichita Falls, Texas.
Very good. All right, the book itself, The Roswell UFO Crash, The Ultimate Guide, written by Noe Torres. I guess Ruben isn't a co-author on this book with you. This is your own effort.
Well, Ruben had some other projects that he was working on, but he certainly collaborated with me on the writing of this book, as we have written a number of UFO-related books and have several projects that we've worked on together. So he was a big factor in this book, although he wasn't listed, credited as an author.
Right.
He was behind the scenes, a very important influence and a very important inspiration to me.
Right.
As was the person who's going to be a guest, a secret guest for you here in a little bit.
Well, we're going to bring this gentleman on right away, because he is such an historic figure in the entire Roswell UFO crash or crashes. There's a lot of arguing going on still about how many events there were. One, two, no one knows for sure, but at least one. We do know that. Our very special guest tonight is the man who wrote the foreword to your book, The Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash, Dr. Jesse Colonel Marcel Jr. Are you there, Colonel?
Yes, sir, I am. Right here.
Welcome back. It's been a number of years since you were on, and I think it was before you went to serve again in Iraq, if my memory is correct. You were called up, or you volunteered and went back over there to help.
Well, they kind of called me back in,
Yeah.
They asked me if I could serve. I said, sure. So if I could pass the flight physical, they said, you're going. So I did, and they did. So.
Wow.
But we got back okay, though.
Well, that's wonderful, and it's quite a situation. In the first hour tonight, we had a gentleman who is serving in Afghanistan right now. He's a National Guardsman, and he's 50 years old, and he's doing guard duty. And while he was up in his guard tower, he saw five lights in a perfect triangular formation come right up and over the mountains. He is in Nandahar, not Kandahar province. And this triangular craft, he is absolutely certain it was one piece, was so big, it came right over his guard tower, stopped right over the base, and was bigger than his entire base underneath. So it was quite a story. All right, how did you get to know Noe Torres?
Well, he contacted me. We just started exchanging email and just got to know each other, and worked out okay.
You continue to be, in many ways, the most important living figure in Roswell. I guess our listeners, most of whom are familiar with your story, should get just a little bit of background. You were 11 years old. Your dad came home one night. But can you give us just, I know you've done this 1,000 times, but tell our listeners, we have new young people listening all the time who don't know the story, and just give a little background, if you would, Jesse, please.
Sure. This is 1,001 times, huh? Yeah,
okay.
My dad was the Air Force intelligence officer for the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947 when he was with the 509th Bomb Group, a composite group that, as you know, dropped the two nuclear weapon zone in Japan.
Right.
Yeah, and so he had a fairly high position in that thing, because as the intelligence officer, he had to know everything that was going on. But as it turns out, there was a crash of some kind of a vehicle on a ranch outside of Roswell, on the Foster Ranch. So the rancher, got on his horse the next day and rode out and saw a lot of debris just scattered about there. The way my dad described it, it was about a half mile by long by three-quarters of a mile wide, so there's a considerable amount of this debris.
Well, as base intelligence officer, I want to underscore the point that this military base was probably without equal in the world. It was the world's first nuclear-capable, nuclear-armed Army Air Force base. Later, of course, they split the services and it became the Air Force and the Army. But these are the best of the best. This is the cream of the crop.
They're all handpicked individuals because, after all, they had a very important mission in the war. And with the 509th Bomb Group, we all know how that ended. They're handpicked men for their training and their knowledge of aircraft and whatever.
Was your dad the first person there, the second person on the scene, the third person on the scene outside of Mac Brazel?
Well, of course, Mac Brazel was the first one, and I guess his son, Bill Brazel,
mm-hmm.
was out there, too. And I guess Mac had contacted the sheriff of Chavez County and had brought some debris in for the sheriff to see, and they didn't know what it was. So the sheriff said, well, why don't we just get this over to the Army Airfield there in Roswell to the 509th. And so Colonel Blanchard, who was the base commander
mm-hmm.
at the 509th, saw this debris and didn't know what the heck it was. So he dispatched my dad and a CIC agent, Sheridan Cavett, out there to go ahead and, you know, recover some of the debris and bring it back to the base so they could get a better look at this.
Mm-hmm. They take pictures of it, too?
You know, they may have. I don't know. Well, I'm sure they would have.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not on the end of the inside of that. But anyway, my dad did pick up representative portions of the debris, and I guess as did Sheridan Cavett. Yeah, my dad was in our private automobile, 42 Buick Special.
Yeah.
And Cavett was in, a carry-all, an Army vehicle. And so they both went down back to Roswell after they picked the debris up. And as it turns out, our house is on the way to the airbase.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad, realizing that this is something very special, that he thought that my mother and myself should look at this. So what he did, even though it was about 1 o'clock in the morning by that time, he spread some debris out on the kitchen floor and woke my mother and myself up. And I thought, what the heck is he doing? He's coming back here at 1 o'clock in the morning.
So he stopped the Buick outside, came in, laid this stuff out on the floor, and woke up the family. All right.
Yep, he did. And he said, look at this. You'll never see anything like this again, which is true. And he was very excited. You know, he thought that this was parts of a flying saucer or words to that effect. I myself did not realize what a flying saucer was. But at looking at the debris, I realized this was something very special and probably not anything of human manufacture.
So your dad knew immediately when he saw the pieces out in the field that this was nothing from the military.
Yeah, he was familiar with all kinds of aircraft.
Yeah, it had to be, of course.
You know, the accident investigation team and so forth. So he was in on the inside of all kind of military aircraft and realized this was not one of those.
Uh-huh. So you're 11 years old. You're sleepy. Did you stay sleepy for long, or did you wake up?
His excitement caught on.
I would think.
Yeah, it got my attention, to tell you the truth. And, I remember this very... I have a voice problem, but...
You sound fine.
Yeah. His first thing that he told us was, look at this and tell me what you think, and look for any electronic debris like vacuum tubes, resistors, condensers, or wires. But there wasn't anything like that. And he already knew, but he wanted me to satisfy my own curiosity there.
Mm. That's a good dad. That's very interesting to challenge you like that. Very smart.
Yeah, he wanted to make sure, you know, let you know what he thought.
Yeah.
And again, you know, there's a lot of metal debris, foil-like things, and beams, metal-type beams, and the strangest thing with the beams, they had symbols along the inside surface.
No question in your mind, these were they stamped in there somehow or engraved? Do you remember anything like that?
I don't know what they were. I do realize they were imprinted on the inside surface of this, an I-beam.
Yeah.
And I thought at first they might have been Egyptian hieroglyphics, but there weren't anything like that. But I do recall the color. They were a very, a light violet hue, semi-reflective of light. Because I held one of the beams up over my shoulder, and the kitchen light was above my shoulder on the left side, and it would reflect back on it. But
that
I don't know if this was embossed or whatever.
That sounds pretty. So the characters themselves had a light violet hue to them.
Yeah.
Very interesting. When we come back, Jesse, I want to ask if you'd describe how big the I-beams were, what they felt like to an 11-year-old, heavy light, how long they were. Were they twisted in any way? Okay, we'll just do that in a minute. Noe, this is great. I want to thank you very much for inviting Jesse Marcel Jr. on, and obviously our thanks go to him as well. We'll be right back with more in just a minute. Okay, and let's get right back to our conversation. Jesse Marcel Jr., who at age 11 is telling us what his dad brought home around 1 a.m. from the Foster Ranch for him to take a look at. So did I hear that right, Jesse, that the characters themselves had a different color than the I-beam?
Well, yeah, the I-beam itself was like a metal, a gray gunmetal color, aluminum or, you know, it was not shiny or anything like that, but the symbols themselves were violet, purple, semi-reflective of light. And they were looked like mathematical symbols or geometric symbols, like, you know, oblate spheroids, triangles, squares, you know, any kind of combination of that, kind of imprinted on the inner edge. I don't know whether they were actually embossed or whatever, but that's what they were.
And how heavy were these I-beam pieces?
Oh.
How big were they? How long were they?
Well, the one I had was about 12 to 18 inches long and had about 3/4 of an inch in cross-sectional diameter. And it was very light. You could tell that, you know, almost like there was nothing in your hands.
Don't you wish you still had it?
If I did, if I had a catch piece, I would not have it now.
I hear that. We've had so many people over the years say the same, well, I had a piece, and they came, knocked on the door, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that's the way they do it.
That's exactly what happened.
They know exactly where these things are and where they go. Noe, please step in here and go ahead with a question or two.
Yes, Jeff, I was just listening to that story, just transfixed by the colonel's description of what he experienced. I remember in the early 1980s reading the very first book ever written about this, the Roswell incident by Berlitz and Moore.
Yeah.
And I remember vividly... I was just reviewing the book right before we went on the air. I still have a copy of it. I remember vividly reading the story of Colonel Marcel in the kitchen of his home there in Roswell, just looking at and handling this debris from that was very obviously not from Earth, as he said.
Right.
And that made such a profound impact on me. It caused me to have a great interest in the topic of unidentified flying objects and in the whole phenomenon over the years. And it also brought to mind something that Colonel Marcel very succinctly and very well put together in the foreword to our book, and that is he explained how... this experience that he underwent in Roswell in 1947 impacted his entire life from that point on. And he was never able to look up in the sky again the same way. And, you know, it was just a life-changing experience for him. And that's something that I'd like to ask him to elaborate on for us a little bit about.
Sure.
How much of an impact it had.
Did you have any idea at age 11 that what you were looking at, I mean, kids at 11 don't usually think too far ahead. I mean, they're absorbed with each day. But as the years went by and you knew this story wasn't going away, I guess you kind of thought it might be part of your life for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, it was a game changer, like Noah says. And what it did for me is to make me realize that, you know, our planet is just one planet among many that are inhabited by civilized people.
Oh, sure.
And obviously some of these are more advanced than we are because they get here from wherever they come from, and I sure like to know where they come from. But what it did, you know, it made me very interested in astronomy and cosmology because I realized that hey, there's others out there. And the other thing it did for me, too, was, you know, I was not a real religious guy at 11 years old, but it sure did make me feel that, you know, God is really who he is. He's omnipotent, and he made more than just us.
He made a lot more than just us. My question is, it's not so much where they come from. Obviously, just our galaxy alone probably has thousands, if not tens of thousands, of inhabited planets.
Oh, you bet. It does.
Intelligent life forms of one degree or another. But why would, I guess, this is such a freak show here. I mean, if I were from another planet, I'd run tours here. You'd go watch these lunatics on this planet destroying their home, which is what we're doing. Not to mention ourselves. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, my feeling is, you know, we're relatively primitive compared to them. And I guess they're like scientists observing like an ant colony.
Yeah.
Is it going to destroy itself, or is it going to continue to evolve into, you know, into a more peaceful situation? And God only knows, you know, war is horrible. And I just got my fill of it in Iraq.
Well, for sure. When did your father pass? I've forgotten.
It was in 1986.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll never forget the picture, the look on his face, and you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The look on his face really kind of told the story, didn't it?
It did. You know, when he was holding a piece of that debris in General Ramey's office, which is very obviously part of a radar target, which was not what we saw in Roswell.
Right,
yeah.
What did you think of the work on enhancing that? Apparently, a telegram that Ramey was holding, or a telex, and getting some text off of that. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it pretty much tells a story with that, you know, because in that memo there was words like victims of the wreck and you know, things like that. And, you know, that's the notes that it was certainly more than just a balloon or whatever they want to call it. Because, you know, there are no victims in a balloon wreck.
No. No. When you were looking at the debris on the floor in the kitchen with your dad, what is your mom saying? What are they talking about? What do you guys think?
Okay, you know, she's a housewife from the 1940s, kind of kept to herself and let the guys do all the talking and all that. But, but she was very interested in this too, and got down on the floor and kind of oohed and aahed with the rest of us there.
That's, and, you know, you were very, we got a break here. You were very lucky. As are all people, so-called baby boomers or shortly before, because you lived in the best of times and you had a real family with a real mom and a real dad, and these kids now, they just don't get it. They don't know.
Yeah.
They don't understand our values, our principles. And
we've lost a lot.
Yes, we have. All right, back in just a couple minutes with our distinguished guests. Okay, and we are back. Jesse Marcel Jr., a medical doctor, Dr. Marcel, his father a major, Jesse a colonel. When you were a boy, did you want to be a doctor when you grew up? Was it one of those kinds of things that kids used to do? Yeah, I want to be a doctor when I grew up, and they did it?
No, I wanted to be a pilot. As a matter of fact, I had dreams of going to Pensacola Naval Air Aviation School in Florida and learning to be a combat pilot.
Huh. Well, all right.
But my mother kind of redirected that thought into medicine.
All right. Now, where are we in the whole Roswell history? How much progress have we made? I mean, what happened to your dad, the picture with his face telling the story? Anybody who looks at the story, even in a cursory fashion, comes away with the obvious truth that it happened. It was quite real. I mean, it's just too much. What did your dad's career, as we look back on this whole story, what happened to your dad in his career after this event?
Okay. Well, you know, as you know, he flew component parts of the wreckage to General Ramey in Fort Worth to let him look at it, since he was an 8th Air Force commander.
Right.
And when they realized what they had, you know, that this was something very, very critically special, my dad was given orders not to ever talk about it again. And I guess
in the military or without or anywhere to
anywhere.
Anybody?
Anywhere.
Huh.
And so when he got back from Fort Worth, you know, they flew the wreckage under armed guard in a B-29. But when he got back from that area there, he sat my mother and myself down and said, look, you know, this didn't happen. It never, you know, don't ever talk about this again. I'm talking about it now, though. But he said, you know, just keep this to yourself. Don't ever talk about it. So I never did talk about it, even among my friends.
And it never came up again. He never obviously told any of his fellow officers or servicemen that
well,
he had stopped.
Well, I think there's a lot of rumors and buzz about something very special happening, but...
Such as?
But he kind of kept it close to himself.
What are the rumors about?
Well, that there was a spaceship or, you know, bodies of extraterrestrials and things like that.
Right.
And very few people were on the inside to know this, though.
Right. Did he say anything to you about bodies?
My wife asked him point blank one day, did he see the bodies? And he said, no, I did not see the bodies. But he knew they were there because he knows of people who did see them. But he himself did not personally observe this.
Did his personal life, did his disposition, did his attitude change after he... In a way, he had to take the fall for this.
Yeah, I don't know that it did. If he did, he kept it to himself.
So he pretty much was the same old dad.
Yeah, as far as I can
tell. I'm glad
to
hear that.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to hear that. I was always wanting to ask you that question. Mm-hmm. Because that was a pretty damned awful thing to have to do.
Well, he was a good soldier.
What's that?
He's a good soldier in his father.
Yeah, I was going to say, a different time, different age, different era. World War II, the ethic of serving, your country right or wrong, you know, it was an honor. When you were told to do something, you damn well did it. And that's been a real...
Cold War ramping up, yeah.
Yeah, that's been a real problem for Roswell investigators, because a lot of these men, and there aren't too many left now, took it with them. They didn't ever break the vow. And in a way, I can understand it, but in another way, we have, in my view, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, a birthright as living, supposedly sentient beings to know officially and formally that we are not alone. Now, we all know that because we're in this business of research, but and the fact of the matter is the government continues to play this asinine cover-up game. And it's highly offensive to me, and I've just ignored it for years. I don't even go there. But don't you agree that we have a right to know and for these people to take it with them? What would you, in other words, let me rephrase this. What would you tell them, Jesse, an older man who is obviously, he doesn't have a lot of time left. What would you tell him about his vow of keeping this quiet? Would you tell him to just, come on, let's not take it with us. Let's share it. What would
you
tell
him? He didn't start talking about this till 1978, when Stanton Friedman got the word out that my dad had something to do with a flying saucer wreck in Roswell, New Mexico. So, but he kept it to himself until that time. Although I think he must have kind of intimated that he saw something very special on his ham radio. He's an avid ham radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he might have told some of his buddies about, hey, you know, we're not alone. There's other guys out there, and more than that, they've been here, and I saw it, you know. And then Stanton got word of that, so then Stanton really interviewed him and got the word out officially, so to speak.
Right. Oh, yeah. Noe, step right in here, please.
I've been wanting to ask Colonel Marcel a question. There's a very dramatic scene in the Showtime movie that was done a few years ago on the Roswell incident, in which his dad walks into a reunion of the 509th bomb group.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of confronts several of the you know, fellow servicemen that he served with back in Roswell about something strange having happened in 1947. And some of them, some of the servicemen were kind of denying that there was anything out of the ordinary. It was a very intense, very dramatic scene. I was wondering if Colonel Marcel might elaborate on, does he feel that was accurately portrayed? Did it really happen that way?
Well, you know, let me put it this way. There's a lot of poetic license in movies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So to my knowledge, and I should have known, that reunion never did happen.
Really?
Yeah, right.
It did not happen.
Did not happen. But that was just part of the story.
Well, yeah,
make a good story better.
That is interesting. It's fascinating, actually. What would you like to see happen, Jesse, if anything would break open on this? What would really be, in your opinion, beneficial to all humankind here?
Well, I think the sure knowledge that we're not alone, that there's certainly more intelligent, obviously more intelligent civilizations than us out there, and it might tend to bring us closer together. You know, like President Reagan said words to that effect in a speech at the United Nations. That,
he did.
You know, what if, you know, there are others out there, and what if they're here? You know, things like that. And that would that not make us closer? And I think they would.
Well, the whole paranoid reaction to these control freaks is that, gee, if we were able to find out about this somehow, we might not be so obedient. You might rear up and say, hey, you guys aren't the number one kids in town.
Right.
It's wild. Hold on, we'll be right back. And one or two more questions for Jesse Marcel Jr. Dr. Marcel, very graciously with us tonight. And we'll do that right after this. Okay, and we're back. Noe, go ahead, ask a question or two if you would, and then I'll come in and we'll let Jesse get some rest here.
Well, I'm just wondering how Colonel Marcel feels about all the research that's been done in the past few years by people like Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, Kevin Randall. They've been able to trace a lot of the former Roswell servicemen and have conducted extensive interviews. A lot more information has come out about what was happening at the base in July 1947, the comings and goings of the various cargo planes and so forth. How much of that, Colonel, have you been able to follow, and what's your opinion of how many witnesses have come forward in the past few years to tell their stories of some very remarkable events there?
Well, you know, I'm not a researcher. I'm just an observer. I saw what I saw, and I know there's a lot of other people who saw the same kind of material. So it's good to get interviews from all the firsthand observers. And unfortunately, I think time is kind of getting rid of a lot of us here, too. I may be one of the last ones here, but it's very valuable research to get these anecdotal experiences put together and tie it down. Now, as far as physical evidence, we don't have that yet.
Now, do you recall, Colonel, back in the late 70s when Stan Friedman first contacted your dad, did he ever tell you that he was kind of hesitant to bring the Roswell incident forward? Was there some hesitation on his part? Or once he made that decision, he and the rest of you in the Marcel family were ready to come forward with it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was no longer at home at that time. I was living here in Montana, and so by the time Stanton got to him, I would call my dad and mom, you know, once or twice a week, whatever. But I was not there when Stanton did this.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure what the circumstances were.
Okay. We have summertime in Roswell coming up. You're going to be down there for much of the festivities, Jesse?
Yeah, I'll be there for part of it, sure.
Do you enjoy meeting people and still talking about this and shaking hands? I mean, is it getting a little tiring?
Well, yeah, I enjoy people. You know, I'm a people person.
Yeah.
So, yes, I enjoy talking with people. And, I like to even talk with the skeptics and try to embellish my feelings upon them.
Uh-huh.
And say, look, it's good to be skeptical. You know, that keeps everybody honest.
Yeah, honest skepticism, yeah.
One of these days, it's all going to come out. And I hope sooner than later, because I'd like to be around when it does come out.
Yeah, it's you know, as I say, the evidence is already like Mount Everest. I mean, we know.
It's
just this stupid media and this idiotic government agenda wanting to hide and hoard everything for itself that is keeping this pretense of us being the only game in the universe, which is beyond the word is really asinine. I mean, it's just a dumb thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you really want to keep this under wraps, because in my opinion, it should not be kept under wraps.
Of course not. No, no, absolutely not. All right, you'll be down in Roswell. What days, Jesse?
Actually, I'm going to leave here in Montana on the 1st of July, and I'll be coming back back home on the 5th of July. So I'll be down there 4 or 5 days.
Very good. Well, all of you who are headed to Roswell will get a chance to shake the hand of a man who held pieces of an extraterrestrial, well, I guess we could call it an aircraft, because it was in the air, and it was, at any rate, it was a ship.
Yeah.
And it was one of many. They've identified, as you know now, nearly 100 purported crash sites around the world. That's a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of these are just probes that are disposable. Because how could they fly light years through space and be dropping like flies out of the skies of our planet here?
I agree. That makes perfect sense.
But I think these are just exploratory probes like we're sending out ourselves.
I agree. Noah, anything you want to add?
Well, I want to say, Jeff, that one of the most remarkable and most enlightening things about going to Roswell during the annual festival over the 4th of July weekend is meeting folks like Colonel Marcel. One of the prized possessions in my library here at home is a first edition of Colonel Marcel's book, The Roswell Legacy, which I want to put in a plug for this. This is the most fascinating book that I've read about the whole Roswell experience that Colonel wrote a couple of years ago with a foreword by Stan Friedman. So these are the sort of treasures that you can pick up, as well as some very interesting thoughts and comments from the Colonel and others who have experienced this phenomenon. So I want to invite all your listeners to make an effort to, if they can't make it to this year's event, the annual Roswell Festival every 4th of July weekend is a fascinating place, a fascinating event.
Indeed.
Thank you for your kind words there.
Anything you want to leave us with tonight by way of final statement here, Jesse?
Well, I guess the message I would like to get over is that we're not alone. That, as far as we know, our visitors do not seem to be have a bad connotation. I don't think they're here malevolently. But and even the Pope has said that, look, belief in extraterrestrial life should not interfere with your belief in God.
Very
good.
That's
exactly right.
Yeah, sure. Makes a lot of sense. Thank you. It's great to have you on the program again. It's been a long time, but I very much appreciate you getting up late here, staying up late, and sharing your story for the 1,001st time.
Yeah, okay. It's fun. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sure. Thanks a lot,
Jesse. And you too, Noah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night, Frank.
Okay.
Yes,
care.
Sir. Thanks to all. And
indeed.
We'll be seeing in Roswell, perhaps.
See you in Roswell.
Okay, Noah.
All right. Well, that's quite a man. And again, called up... he's not in his 20s, called up to go serve in Iraq, and he said, yeah, I'll be right there to help. And he went over there. I guess he was there for, a year? I don't know. He was there for quite a while. Doctor helping, trauma units and all that. So he's a real great American, just like his dad. Thank you, Noy, for making that available.
Well, it was a fantastic experience to listen to the Colonel. Thank you for having us on. Yes.
Oh, of course. Well, we got about 5 minutes until the break here at the top, and we're going to come back next hour with you and someone we have not had on the program before, E.J. Wilson. And there's a lot to be talked about with him in terms of what's going to go on at Roswell. What is your connection with E.J.?
Well, E.J. is just a fascinating guy. He's worked at the Roswell UFO Museum for several years. He's got a very interesting background. He's an author in his own right. And he took close to 200 pictures of Roswell for our book, The Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash, which was just released a couple months ago. So he experienced firsthand, the Roswell Festival and the whole experience. He'll have some unique insights to share with us.
Very good. Roswell itself is still a long way from most anywhere. How do most people get there, Noy? What's the easiest way for people? Did they fly in there?
Actually, you know, American Airlines has just, in the past couple of years, American Airlines has a connecting flight from DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth.
Uh-huh.
And so it's really pretty convenient because you can fly from most anywhere in the country to DFW and then just take a smaller plane that American Airlines runs under its American West label out of DFW.
And
you fly
be.
Right into the same airport where all these interesting developments happened back in 47, actually, because it's the old Roswell Army Airfield.
So the Roswell, yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. So the Roswell Airport is the 509th.
A lot of people don't realize that those were the very runways that were used to transport this debris, this UFO debris, these alien bodies in and out of Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Following the crash, and we can certainly talk more about that. We're going to actually be offering a walking tour of the old Roswell Army Airfield during this UFO festival, and EJ and I and Ruben will be leading people on tours of the facility, of some of the very buildings where these strange happenings occurred back in 47.
Wow. Well, as you heard Colonel Marcel say, his dad was ordered to fly, not all necessarily, but certainly a significant amount of the debris to Fort Worth to be examined by the top brass down there. And the information going back and forth between them and the Pentagon must have been amazing.
There was an interesting angle there, Jeff, and we can talk about this in the next hour, but when we were doing the research on Colonel Willingham's encounter, we ran across the person who was the base commander at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth.
At the time?
During the 40s, when the Roswell incident happened.
Uh-huh.
And he intimated to his son, we contacted his son, and his son intimated to us that his dad was very much in the know-how, in the know as to mm-hmm. what happened in Roswell in 47. And seemed to have a good fix on the fact that the military had indeed come across extraterrestrial artifacts.
Well, what how much did Dad share with his kid?
His father was a career military guy, had risen to a very high rank, and he
right.
was very guarded in his comments. However,
right.
he did share. You know, he told us, the son told us, that It was very clear in conversing with his dad, even though not a lot of words were said, it was very clear that his dad was in the know about extraterrestrial visitations that the military had become aware of. Apparently, Carswell Air Force Base was a key player in several incidents, including the Roswell 1947 case, also in Willingham's case as well.
Wow, very interesting. All right, well, there's a lot of information out there, and it's quite a search to try and unearth and find it. All right, back in a few minutes with E.J. Wilson and Noe Torres as we continue our third hour, coming up next. Okay, let's get into hour number three. Noe Torres is back with us, and we're going to meet E.J. Wilson. Now, what's really interesting, and I didn't know this, when I thought Roswell built a new airport for some reason, but they're using the old 509th and the original buildings. We'll find out how many are still there. And for those of you who make the trip to Roswell, you can go with Noe and Ruben and E.J. and on a walking tour, apparently, of the base. And this will be very, very interesting. Noe, it was also interesting to find out from Colonel Marcel that there was no reunion.
I had suspected that there were a lot of parts of that movie that were greatly enhanced for Hollywood purposes.
Well, invented.
Yeah, downright invented, that's right. And I had asked Colonel Marcel about a couple of other scenes in the movie before.
Uh-huh.
And he had indicated that those were not correct either. They were either, very much over-dramatized or they
right.
were completely fabricated. So it didn't surprise me that the scene with the reunion at the very beginning of the movie, which was very, very important to the movie, where Marcel's father appears there and talks to a lot of his fellow servicemen, it doesn't surprise me that that was also added for dramatic effect.
Wow. All right, let's say hello to E.J. Wilson. Why don't you introduce him to our listeners, if you would, and we'll find out about his background and what people can do this 4th of July down in Roswell with all three of you. This is very interesting.
Yeah, he lives in the Roswell area and has lived there for a number of years with his wonderful wife, Annie. And E.J. was instrumental, tremendously important in the writing of our book, Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash. Not only was did he do all the photography, but he helped me with the research. He connected me with the folks at the Historical Society for Southeast New Mexico, making historical photographs of Roswell back in the 1940s. A lot of the locations that we've been talking about, the old air base, they had a lot of photos in their collection, which EJ hooked me up with. So I'm very happy to have EJ with us tonight. He's a longtime resident, as I said, of the Roswell area, and can give us a lot of interesting insight into the historical case.
Very good.
Case.
Very good. All right, EJ, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jeff, and hello, Noe. Good to hear you again. How is everyone?
We're fine, and we all want to know what EJ stands for.
That would be my first name and middle name.
Now, I would have guessed that. Obviously, we're not going to get very far with this line of questioning. Nor are we going to get very far with the rumor that American Airlines, on their flight from DFW to Roswell, flies a round, disc-shaped commuter craft.
Oh, good one. I had not heard that one.
You can use mock one up and put it out there with America. What is it? America what? America West?
America West. That's
put
right.
America West livery on the outside of it, just for kicks.
Well, I actually, Jeff, have never flown into Roswell, although I've driven the past. Actually, this is my fourth year to speak at the UFO Festival. Along with Ruben, and so I've never actually flown there. I'm looking forward to the experience of flying into the very airport where all these bizarre happenings took place in 47.
Well,
so,
that's where the bodies were there at one point, all the wreckage was there.
Oh, yeah, everything was brought. Everything was brought from the crash site north of town and was housed there for a number of days. Afterward, there were witnesses saying that they were seeing, pieces of the debris, the actual main body of the craft in one of the aircraft hangars there, as well as bodies that they described as being, of course, not human. So a very interesting place, and I have kind of this eager anticipation and foreboding about actually flying in there for the first time ever.
All right. EJ, what got you involved with all this in the museum?
Wow. Okay. Just to make it... brief, I got started in 1964, and I know what you're going to say, Jeff. EJ, you're far too young, and thank you, you're very kind, but I was just 4 years old when I got started.
Absolutely.
My mother came home and informed the immediate family, and really only the immediate family, that she and several other witnesses had had seen a saucer landed in broad daylight at Air Force Base in Georgia. And, of course, we were excited about that. But there were all I can tell you from my memory of the event is that, first of all, she would never fabricate anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you knew this lady, if she said something, you could take it to the bank.
Well, we don't want to use that analysis anymore. We'll take it to somewhere else. Like.
Oh, yeah, I guess with
don't,
the economy,
don't take it
the economy the way it is.
That's
you
right.
Could, you could, she never lied to us. So
I understand.
Really
well, that was the American family back then. There were just different times, different values, different people. What it is now is frightening in many cases.
Exactly. So she's coming around the bend on All Good Road, and there are several cars pulled over. and they're all sitting there watching this thing, a classic saucer with a dome, no visible windows, so no beings were seen, but there were multiple witnesses, and then after it sat there for a while, it just took off. And that was really all there was to that story, but it's mm-hmm. significant because it got me interested.
Hmm.
And I've been, how do we say this, kind of interested in not just UFOs and aliens, but also the larger picture that we're not alone in the universe, and there's a lot more out there than just what we see around town on a daily basis.
It's all true. Well, you mentioned around town. There are many people, and I'm one of them, who believe that certainly some of our visitors from some planet or planets are walking amongst us in our towns. I think it's
yes,
certainly...
that I believe that too. If you're familiar with the Disclosure Project and Dr. Stephen Greer, a few of his witnesses that he has have reported that we have cataloged 57 different species of aliens, and at least two of them look like you and me.
So it's 57 now. I remember there was a book, doggone it, who wrote it? It was called An Alien Taxonomy. It was pretty much a general guide of the known or relatively speaking acknowledged species. I've seen what looked like a person on a street, and it's a story I don't want to get into, which
mm-hmm.
left me with no doubt that I was looking at least a hybrid.
Yes. Well, I'm in the same boat with you. I was working at the museum for a couple of years, and on at least two occasions, and I pointed out to a coworker, there were some people that just couldn't be regular humans. Now, occasionally you see a regular human that's a little bit different from, you know, maybe the eyes are a little bit wider apart or something. But this person that I'm thinking of was well over 6.5 feet tall, probably 300 pounds, and his eyes were on the side of his head like a horse. Nothing approaching what you would think of as a human. And
wow, that's not even something you could get away with easily without this isn't a busy location.
They checked in with the Texas postal code, and the big fella, the alien looking one, didn't say a word.
Huh.
The whole time they were there, as far as I could tell, but his human friend did all the talking for them.
So weird.
That was very unusual. And
yeah,
I said to my, you know, it's a horseshoe shape, so when they go in, they're going to come out about the same place. So I said to my coworker, keep an eye out for the big fella, and see what you think. And she said, oh yeah, yeah, that's not one of us. So, you know, we're not being mean here. You know, we know there are regular people that have problems or whatever, but to us, and when you get a look at someone like that and you get a real feeling of alienness, and it's not like you're looking at a human with maybe a defect.
I understand.
This is an otherworld person.
Now, if you had it to do over again, would you make an effort to engage the person in conversation?
No.
Really?
I'm sure that would be beyond the protocol that we were allowed at the museum. You know, I'm sure I would have been...
Well, I don't mean you should go up and say, all right, buddy, what planet are you from? You know, just talk to him. Say,
I tried that when they checked in.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you fellas from the, I think, in fact, it was the Dallas area.
But you said Pleiades, didn't you? All right, hold on. We got to take a break here. We'll come right back with more in just a few minutes. Noe Torres and E.J. Wilson getting ready for the big Roswell 4th of July celebration. Okay, and we're back talking with E.J. and Noe. All right, guys.
Hello again.
Yes, hello again. So at least one odd fellow came through the museum. How many thousands of people have been through the museum now?
Well, we were averaging probably 400 to 500 a day throughout the year, sometimes more, sometimes less.
That's extraordinary. It's hard to underestimate. It's hard to overestimate what the museum has meant to Roswell. That's amazing.
We were told about 165,000 human visitors per year visited the museum.
Huh.
It's interesting that what this brings up about aliens coming to visit. If you are an alien, and I'm not saying you are, I'm just saying if one is an alien and can pass for human, it would be logical to go through the museum and see what we know about them.
It would also be logical to give them a complimentary visit, not charge them.
Yes. Well, hey, if I thought he was an alien, I probably would have let him in for free.
Well, if he'd have been 5'1", you might have. But that's too big.
If he had said, hey, I'm from Alpha Centauri or wherever, I would have said, okay, go on in.
Jeff, I wanted to jump in there. You made the point about how much the museum and the UFO festival held every year in July means to the city of Roswell. I was just reading in the Roswell newspaper online a few days ago that they have decided, apparently the city council has decided not to fund the UFO festival for the coming year, 2011. So, in other words, they have funding for this year, and everything's going on as planned, but they have zero funding in the budget, which has already been submitted for 2011. And I've been reading a lot of reaction to that on the net about how that's basically like slicing your own jugular, because, the UFO festival is the lifeblood of the economy of the town.
Yeah, sure.
There.
Yeah, is the museum being updated all the time, new exhibits, new things? How is that going? That's always interesting because it's a lot of stuff out there.
Yes, we had much more to show than we had space to show it. And so if and when the new museum opens, and it's looking good so far, then there will be space for everything. To answer your question, there are a few things that I would like. I'm sure we'll have at the new place or with when they get more space. I'd like to have more information on the Phoenix Lights and some things that probably no one has heard about, like the sighting in China at the Purple Mountain Observatory. Has anyone been on your show talking about that?
No, please. Let's go
okay,
into that.
Okay, I can explain that one. It was during the solar eclipse, which was July 23rd of last year, wasn't it? And there were some students at the Purple Mountain Observatory in China. There were roughly 20 graduate students there, and they were all filming the eclipse. We didn't get the solar eclipse here in North America, but they got it in China. And real astronomers there, real scientists, held a press conference, and they told flat out they have filmed a walnut-shaped craft for 40 minutes.
That's a long time.
These are real scientists. This is not Jimmy Joe Bob Fricky driving through a cornfield on a Saturday
night.
Well,
they have over 50. How many? No, not 50. It's like 250,000 UFO researchers or people who are seriously interested in the subject or more in China. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, that's true. So here, now, of course, the Chinese government got the video, but the students got their own video on their cell phones and camcorders and what have you. And if you just do a little bit of Googling, you'll see, just Google for Purple Mountain UFO, and you can actually see the news accounts in Mandarin Chinese, but also there are some in English. And the thing that to me just blew my mind was that this was all over the news in China, Asia, not just there, but also Europe the United Kingdom. It was in the newspapers. It was on TV. We didn't hear a whisper.
When did this happen, EJ? Excuse me. When did this happen?
July 23rd. I'm pretty sure it was 09. Let me double check.
I remember running a story from probably something like the Singapore Times or a Chinese outlet about this, and that was it. It was very short-lived.
It was in the London Telegraph newspaper also.
Yeah, the Brits would be ones to carry something like that. They're being constantly visited.
That was July 22nd, 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the American media is a sham. It's a fraud. It's basically a mind control disinformation agency.
You're correct about that. This is a good spot for me to bring up what I call my tabloid theory, and that is anything that we're supposed to believe they print in the New York Times or San Francisco Chronicle or Denver Post or something like that,
right.
Anything we're not supposed to believe, they put on the cover of the Weekly World News next to a story about woman trapped in mason jar for 3 days, rescuers baffled.
Hey, listen,
you know?
Those tabloids are the source of some very interesting, real news.
Yes,
mixed
exactly.
in with a lot
but
of...
But not to be believed. It's to be disbelieved. And so it's actually a tool.
Fun way to dish it off, you're right. All right, hang on back in a couple of minutes as we continue with Noe and EJ.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and we're back. All right, guys, I forgot where we were. Where were we? We're talking about the China issue, and the American media is owned by five or six corporations. It's very simple to put a chokehold on anything they want at any time. The CIA and Operation Northwoods bragged that they could put any story on any media outlet they wanted within an hour, and that was in the 1950s. They run the media here. They and the other special interest groups that control much of the country.
Exactly. So on one hand, we have our government telling us this is not a real phenomenon, and if you believe in it, you're just a kook or a conspiracy theorist. And on the other hand, we have the aliens, I think in some cases, for example, the Purple Mountain Observatory. I mean, they pick broad daylight, and they pick the solar eclipse time and place to show themselves. I think they knew everyone would be looking at the solar eclipse, and so they just show up very nearby the actual eclipse in the sky, so they're not to be missed.
Hey, the same thing happened in Mexico a few years ago in the mid to late 90s. There was an eclipse, and there were hundreds of UFO sightings all over in the Mexico City area. So,
it does seem that in different countries and different cultures, they make little pretense about their presence, and even here, they seemingly have been intent upon being noticed, shall we say.
Well, exactly. One example I used when I was at the museum, and I would be giving tours. I was the only paid tour guide, and the people would ask me all the time, what about, we had a wonderful, by the way, we still do have a wonderful crop circle exhibit. And the crop circle movie that they show.
Nice.
And people say, well, what's the deal with the crop circles? And I would say, well, anybody's guess, but if you want my opinion, I think it's alien graffiti. I think the aliens are doing things to the fields they know we can't reproduce, and we know we can't reproduce. I'm talking about the real ones, not the fake ones by, you know, Doug and Dave in the United Kingdom, two very spry elderly gentlemen with a board and rope. But the real ones, you've seen some of those very complex designs in the fields with mathematical encodings like pi and other things, and just things we can't do. We can barely do it. There was a perfect mathematical fractal, and that's my background. And I know we can't do that in a field. We can barely do it on a computer screen, but not in a field. And so
in the dark at night, and not leave other footprint evidence around and all the rest of it.
Exactly. So that's the alien saying, hello, we're here, even though your government doesn't want you to believe in us. So they're kind of reaching out directly and letting us know that we're not alone in the universe.
I think another prime example of that, EJ, was the Phoenix Light incident, which is also covered very well in several museum exhibits. I know you're a big proponent of what happened with the Phoenix Light.
Yes, March 13th, 1997. This craft started out after just a little bit after 8 o'clock in the evening, visited virtually every populated center in Arizona, and was seen by 100,000 people. 100,000. Let that sink in for just a moment. That's twice the population of Roswell. So, including the governor of the state, Fife Symington himself, in a very nice award-winning documentary was made about that event by Dr. Lynn Kitai. I've seen it. It's excellent. But this craft was a mile long and a mile wide. If, as some people say, it was a secret military aircraft, this was not a good place to test it.
Yeah.
And if it was flares, like they also said, actually retroactively said they were flares, then it didn't behave like any flares known to man. I'm pretty sure we don't make flares that don't behave the laws of physics.
Peter Davenport and I did what I think was one of the best radio programs, and it was such because of the eyewitnesses. We had a whole family on, and they laid on their grass and looked straight up as this enormous, gigantic machine went right over their home. Come on, it had nothing to do with flares whatsoever. They described
it,
you know, we're talking 12-year-old kids, mom, dad, it works. They just, the neighbors, everybody was out. Yeah, this was an extremely ostentatious display of advanced technology.
It even made the national newspaper, the USA Today, albeit 3 months later.
3 months later, June. Before the Roswell, the big first Roswell to-do. And that's why the Phoenix Light story was broken, because of you guys at Roswell.
That's a very good point, yeah. And I want to say something nice about Peter. We would refer people to the UFO Reporting Center, the New Fork, National UFO Reporting Center, all the time. Yeah, because when you work at the UFO Museum, every day you're going to hear someone's personal story of a sighting. And you know, we would encourage people, you should go ahead and report that, add to the body of knowledge. And we would get them in touch with him. And I really admire what Mr. Davenport is doing, and doing really all of it on his own. It's very impressive what he has put together. So bless him for what he's doing.
Oh, indeed. Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. Okay, so what's on tap with this walking tour? Tell us, and I assume the original hangar is still there.
Yes, it is. I was there yesterday.
Ought to be declared a national landmark.
I think that we're working on that. Noe lay the groundwork, and I'll just jump in if I have something to add.
Go ahead.
It's his idea, and it's brilliant, by the way. So go for it, Noe.
One of the things that we discovered, Jeff, when we were thinking about writing a book that covered the historical angle of the UFO crash and looking at all the places where it happened in town that still exist, encouraging people to go out and visit those sites so that they can be assured that this was a real historical event and that, you know, it comes forward through time to our day today. Well, one of the things that we discovered was that, unfortunately, a lot of, not a lot, but several of the key places that were involved in the 1947 incident have been demolished. So it was something that we had to work on through this book to try to preserve as much of it as we could.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to find out about this demolishing, who was behind it, which buildings were taken down, and why, and so forth. Hang on, we'll be right back. One more segment to go, and then we'll be into the weekend already here, the last weekend in June. OK, Okay, let's get back to Roswell and the 509th, the former 509th Air Force Base, Army Air Base. Go ahead, Noy, tell us more.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating things that we discovered when we were thinking of doing the book in the first place was that, you know, some of these sites are starting to disappear. For example, the place where Mac Braswell took the debris from the field out there at the ranch where he worked, he brought it first to the sheriff's department, to the county sheriff's department, to Travis County. That building has been demolished. The material was in there for a while Braswell was in town. And then several of the buildings down at the Air Force Base back in 47 have been demolished, such as the Air Base headquarters, where Colonel William Blanchard was making all the decisions, making all the calls regarding the
that was where the Marcel picture was taken, right? Those photos.
The Marcel picture was taken back at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
But the press release that was done by Walter Hout announcing that the RAAF, the Roswell Army Airfield, had in its possession a crashed flying saucer, was composed there at the headquarters building. So EJ and Ruben and I decided, you know, before these places disappear, we've got to get some documentation on them, some photographs, and maybe encourage people to go out there and visit with them. Another person who was instrumental in this effort was John LeMay, historian there who lives in Roswell and works for the Historical Society for Southeast New Mexico as a volunteer. And so we all kind of put our heads together, and they helped tremendously with coming forth with the ultimate guide to the Roswell UFO crash, which is subtitled A Tour of Roswell's UFO Landmarks. What we're trying to do is focus attention on the need to preserve these sites, get folks to go out and visit them and experience them for themselves, and realize that this was a true historical event of great significance. So one step beyond that was I came up with the idea of not just talking about the book once it came out and showing them the places as they're described in the book, but actually to take people out to these sites and let them walk around, let them see the aircraft hangar where the crashed UFO and the bodies were seen by a number of witnesses who have provided testimony and affidavits, people like Walter Hout, the lieutenant governor of New Mexico back in 1947, Montoya,
What's in the hangar now?
In the hangar now, it's being leased by a company based in Guthrie, Oklahoma, called Stewart Industries. Basically, what they do is they take old aircraft and they tear them down. They strip them down for parts, and they sell them in the used aircraft parts market.
Mm-hmm.
They're one of the largest firms in the United States that does this. They're very friendly folks. They are very cooperative with us in the writing of the book. They gave us a tour of the facility. We're trying to work out a deal where we can use the facility during the UFO festival. But basically in the hangar now is, there's an odd assortment of aircraft in various states of disrepair being taken apart for
these are contemporary aircraft, not historic aircraft.
No, these are contemporary, right.
Yeah.
You
need to get a B-29 and get that hangar turned into a National Historical Monument, get the Air Force behind it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's been argued very heavily, and John LeMay, the Historical Museum, has really lent his voice to this, that before these places disappear, really there needs to be some designation of historical landmarks. There needs to be some effort to preserve these important places that are an important part of history. So
the interesting thing about building 84 is the sign out front, when they turned it into the Roswell Air Center, they kept the building number the same. I found that very interesting.
And another very unique thing about that building is the strange little room in the back called the Gray Room. And EJ has some very interesting thoughts about when he first walked in there to take pictures. Do you want to, we have time to share those, Jeff?
Sure, yes, yeah. Exactly.
Well, we've got about 6 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, this applies to other locations, but the overall feeling when you go into a place, you're not just looking at a place, you're looking at history, and what goes through your mind is there were actual people here that saw the alien bodies. There were real people, and it must have changed their lives forever. So it's not just about a place, it's also about an event in history that was so significant we almost lose perspective on that. It almost becomes commonplace, but it's of monumental importance. And this is why we, and Noe and I were actually talking about this yesterday, we go through a lot in our research and setting things up and everything, and there's no question it's worth everything we're doing and all of the effort because it is so important. So,
one of the important sites that's been obliterated was the Roswell Army Air Field Hospital, which stood near Building 84, and that was where the so-called alien autopsy was reportedly performed, according to a number of witnesses. And so that was one of the most significant parts in what people call the Roswell experience or the Roswell literature. And unfortunately, that one was lost some years ago. It was demolished and is now a vacant lot. So as EJ was saying, it becomes really, really important for us to try to document not just the history of it, but also to try to preserve the physical artifacts of where this all happened.
All right, what are the chances of getting the building redesignated as a National Historical Landmark? I mean, where does it stand?
Well,
who do you talk to? Certainly your state congressmen or women,
absolutely,
and state senators ought to be involved.
Yeah, it has to go through the government channels. And one of the things that's happened there at the, as far as Building 84, which is probably the most important site that we should go after for preserving right now, people have said that the Building 84 site is so significant, in fact, that really would be the place, that really should be the place that we should target to try to keep it from continuing on as a private concern.
Would that be something, and I don't know how big that is compared to the current museum location, but would that be a secondary location?
It definitely should be some kind of a commemorative place for the 47 event. You know, the museum is building this technologically advanced, high-tech, multi-million-dollar location back in downtown Roswell, and that's fantastic. We're all looking forward to seeing that. They're going to have a tremendous amount of space, and it's going to be a real showplace there. But in terms of history, the history that needs to be preserved, really, Building 84, something needs to be done with it to allow for people to experience what happened there and to see it for themselves.
So what's the agenda? What's the timeline on this? How many years does it take? I mean, it's obviously surplus property. I don't know who owns the actual grounds that the airport is on now. Is that owned by the city of Roswell?
Yes.
Do they buy it all up?
Yes.
Well,
the city
of Roswell owns the building.
I don't know who owns the building. I know that the airport is owned by the city of Roswell. When the base was closed in 1967, the property reverted back to the city.
Well, you may already own it.
But it could well be. Yeah.
We're going to have to do a little more research on that, Jeff. We've been so focused on the historical aspects of it. And
sure.
We know John LeMay has mentioned to us that there's been kind of a grassroots effort to preserve some of the Roswell buildings and artifacts. But beyond that, we haven't really delved into it as deeply as we should.
Well, they need to get after that. That building and that part of the airport certainly are truly historic grounds, and it would only mean even more tourism money for Roswell, if they could build a mock-up of what the craft may have looked like, you know, a larger piece of it, they could recreate the whole scene in there. That's a big building.
I think
like that. That's
good. That's a wonderful idea, and that kind of jives with what we've been thinking of. We're going to do, I think, one modest little step toward that may be to start offering tours of the area, let people experience it firsthand. Nobody, to our knowledge, has ever taken folks around so that they could see it themselves. So maybe we can kind of generate some interest by doing this first step.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how the City Fathers could do anything but say, generally, this is great. We've got to move on this. Let's not waste any time. Let's not have a 10-year plan. Let's get after it. People always take too much time doing obvious things to me. I don't know. I'd say
exactly.
Get right on it.
And the first challenge is getting attention on it, which I love this walking tour idea because NOAA has single-handedly invented really a new aspect or a new industry,
right,
actually, on the UFO event.
How many, excuse me, we're almost out of time, EJ. How many visitors a year in the museum?
165,000.
Okay, and what is the admission cost?
Wow, at the time I was there, and I think it's probably still the same, it's $5 for adults and $2 for children.
All right, good point. 160,000. You add a dollar to it to purchase the hangar. 160,000.
Right.
What could the thing be worth? $300,000.
Exactly.
You got 3 years of an excise tax, so to speak, on a mission, and you own it. Anyway.
Sure, exactly.
Good luck. Nice to talk to you, EJ. Pleasure to have you on the program. Have a wonderful time down
there.
Thank
you. Pleasure's all mine.
Okay, Noe.
Best of luck, Jeff.
Thank you for everything, and thanks for bringing Colonel Marcel on. That was a real treat.
Oh, it was wonderful. Yes,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, take good care. Thanks. Say hi to Ruben.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening, everyone.
Good night.
Okay.
Thanks,
see
EJ.
See you, Noe.
All right, and thanks to all of you for being here. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care of yourselves, and every day counts. Talk to you soon. Yeah.